Well, I spend most of my time running a research program. I do work a day and a week in a clinic, which is a clinic for children and young people with autism and what we call complex needs. That means that actually young people with autism and mental health difficulties. But most of the time I'm running a research program, which is partly my group here, other groups here at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience, collaborators both across the UK, in Europe, in North America. And we do a very wide range of things, I think that would be fair to say. So we run intervention trials, and some of those are things where we're working with parents to help them manage the way their children are behaving and developing. Some of the trials are pharmacological studies of drugs. We do a lot of studies on how autistic people grow up over time. So we've been following some children since they were young, and then we've seen them through adolescence. We've recently seen the young autistic adults at the age of 23. We have other studies where we study siblings who have an older brother or sister with autism, who have something between a 10 and 20% likelihood themselves of also being autistic, and we study them from the very first few months of life. In fact, now we're studying some from before they're born. And we see those children, and colleagues at Birkbeck see them in a baby lab at 6 and 12 months, and my team see them at 2 and at 3, and we're just about to start following up some of those young children, some of whom are autistic and some of whom have other developmental problems, and many of whom are doing fine in mid-childhood, so about 6 to 9 years of age, particularly with a focus on trying to understand what things in infancy tell us something about who goes on to have autism, who goes on to have other mental health difficulties like anxiety and ADHD, to try and see if understanding those early predictors helps us do things like develop earlier interventions. We do a lot of developmental cognitive neuroscience, so we use lots of sort of technologies like EEG and eye tracking, so it's measuring brain activity, measuring where people are looking, measuring skin conductance and heart rate, arousal, and then combine that with a lot of behavioral experimental measures and clinical sort of measures. Yeah, so that's a sort of range of work that we do that's quite wide and involves studying people from infancy through to adulthood. Well, I think that's something that we've all become much more aware of. I think, you know, historically, I was one of the people who had a focus on early childhood because we were doing a lot of studies on early screening way back in the early 1990s, so more than 25 years ago. And then we saw some of the youngest children who had ever been studied following a diagnosis before the age of 2. So that was, you know, quite a lot of focus on my early career was on young children. And partly because those children have grown up now into adults. There are people that I remember seeing personally as part of my PhD back in 1991, 1992, who our group just saw at the age of 23. What I really hope one day is to write a case series on those 6 or 8 individuals that we've literally seen from infancy through to young adulthood. I think it's also very interesting that, you know, so that makes you want to have to think about what the issues are as people do age and grow into sort of adulthood, and that naturally comes with sort of thinking about the cohorts that we've been sort of working with. I think it's also true that even thinking about friends, I have a couple of friends who are parents, and of course when I first met them, that was around the soon after their children were diagnosed at quite a young age, at sort of 3 or 4, and now their children are again in their sort of early 20s, and you know, some live in care homes and some live independently and some have been to university. So the parents that I befriended over these sort of years, their children have grown up and sort of in a sense all the concerns that that sort of mattered to them for thinking about their child's future and what happens when they're not able to provide the support that they sort of currently do. Those are really live issues for everyone, I think, in the sort of community. And, you know, things change. It's interesting in sometimes both science and clinical practice can be frustrating, partly because sometimes you feel that the pace of change is so slow, the accumulation of knowledge is so incremental. But I've been in the field researching autism. Next year it'll be 30 years. And actually, sometimes you think, gosh, a lot has happened, a lot has changed, and one of the big changes has been so many groups all around the world are now sort of working out what we should be thinking about, studying, what methods are relevant, what questions are relevant. Even some people here, colleagues at the Institute here at King's, are thinking about Francesca Happe, thinking about autism and aging. And issues that brings up, and I can think of other colleagues in Europe who are also asking those same questions. So that's a big change from what we were doing, thinking of 20 or 30 years ago. I think it's progressed quite a lot from probably a rather poor start 30 years ago, where there wasn't very much meaningful involvement at all. I have been involved in some initiatives, including things, John, that you and I have collaborated on in the sort of past, which have been sort of, you know, fruitful and sort of useful and very interesting. I think in increasingly in sort of interesting ways, sort of involved sort of people with autism and parents in discussion around sort of some of the work we do. So with a colleague here, Emily Simonoff, we've been running a government-funded program called I Am Health, which is improving autism mental health. So it's studying again from childhood through to adulthood, using a number of things, longitudinal studies and some work we call biographies, which is asking autistic people about their experience of, for example, having mental health difficulties, being in contact with psychiatric services, both as children and now as adults. And we're also leading a group parent training program to help parents manage emotional and behavioral problems, so early manifestations of mental health difficulties in very young children as part of that program. And we've had for the past 5 years in that program to what we call PPI, that's the NIHR Speak, which is some public patient and public involvement, but essentially it means autistic people and family members, parents often other family members. And we've had two PPI panels. One is a group of about five adults who are autistic, and one is a group of parents of children who are autistic, and we've had meetings with them about every part of the program on a sort of regular basis. And that's sort of, you know, definitely had an influence sort of throughout, even right at the very beginning of some of the names we were giving to some of the instruments we were using, we changed. Really sort of helping us think about the way that information sort of conveyed, you know, that's going to be important at the end of that sort of study. You know, I think in common with lots of other sort of work, you know, I don't think it would be true to say that at the start when we wrote that program grant, it's NIHR program sort of grant, we wholly involved autistic people in the grant writing process or in the applicant sort of group. But the consideration that we would have meaningful sort of involvement sort of throughout was sort of taken sort of seriously and set up before we started the study. You know, I think there are other sort of studies I'm involved in where the input is more indirect or comes a little bit sort of later, and that's a challenge still. I mean, that's a challenge still in terms of actually it's relatively rare still. I only really have one good experience of this, of co-writing grants with autistic individuals, and that's quite rare and has to be the right sort of setting. But sometimes when you're responding to a particular call a funder puts out, they tell you what they want, so you want to get the project funded, so you tell them you're going to give them what they want, you know. And so sometimes even the research question to some extent can be sort of preset. I think there's a generation of younger scientists, younger than myself, who are sort of growing up, where they're starting in a very different place than I did 29 years ago, you know, where they're sort of expecting some of that engagement and discussion and involvement and co-production and participation to be there from the very beginning. And I think that's great. And, you know, I hope that becomes the norm, and that, you know, I think we're in an interesting time. It'd be interesting to check back in 10 years and see how well we've done. Well, I think there's a, you know, to use a familiar word in a different context, I think there's a bit of a spectrum or dimension of sort of positions that different sort of funders might take. I, you know, am involved in things that are funded by charities, including Autistica, who funded some of the work we've sort of done and some of our current work from, you know, the research councils, particularly the Medical Research Council, National Institutes for Health Research, so NHS, you know, England Research sort of money. Some of the large American charities, Simons and Autism Speaks, have funded our research, and you know, some of the European projects I'm involved in are a co-funded but also co-run by the pharmaceutical industry and academic sort of partners. And across, you know, those sort of projects, I think there is quite a wide sort of, you know, range of sort of differences in the degree to which sort of, you know, some of the sort of topics are pre-specified or chosen on the part of the funders versus sort of what we call investigator-initiated, where you come up with an idea that's a good idea that you think is going to have a meaningful impact and, you know, you pitch it to the funders and it either does or doesn't get funding. I mean, you know, one comment would be that the people I work with, for example, from the pharmaceutical sort of industry, you know, I think their intentions, you know, and motivations are very genuine. The discussions we have about improving people's lives are very real. You know, it's not, you know, it doesn't feel like a two sort of sided discussion. Having said that, of course, they are commercial companies, and that to pretend that doesn't potentially make a difference would be rather naive. Just thinking about some of the industry sort of partners that we work with, and you know, I know Roche, who are one of the partners on some of the European work that we do, have had a good involvement over the past few years of autistic people and parents in when they're setting up new studies. And I was at a meeting earlier this year in New York where we had a panel of autistic people and parents and people from charities and people from government funding agencies and then academics like me and you know, sitting around the table giving the company advice about some of their future plans, you know. So I'm sure there are differences, you know, and I'm sure it's important to sort of question sort of motivations. I think I personally keep an open mind, not, I think, because I'm sort of naive, but there's enough of me that's sort of optimistic about the fact that there can be genuine sort of collaboration and ambition for things that you think clinically may make a meaningful difference. I mean, it's in some ways, of course, because I do spend a day a week in the clinic and always have done. You know, in the past that was at Great Ormond Street here in London for a long time, but for the past 6 years it's been here in South London and Maudsley Trust, where I work in this service I mentioned before for young people with autism and mental health difficulties. You know, a lot of them are teenagers, a lot of them are late teenagers and going to be moving to adult sort of services. And when you talk with them, when you talk with their parents and carers about their future and what they want and what their ambitions for their lives are, which you do as part of a fairly routine sort of interview that we would do, you know, you do face sort of every week that actually people's lives may be quite challenged and they may need support and with getting to do the things they'd like to do. Now, that's not unique for any 17 or 18 year old. Actually, the future's pretty scary for most of them. But I think there's an additional challenge if, for example, you're autistic. If you're autistic and you have, you know, a mood disorder, or you know, you find many situations challenging, then you know you might need different help, different support from other sort of people. And one of the really interesting things about having that sort of, I was a clinician first, but then decided I didn't want to work in the health service, so I became an academic as my plan B. Is that you sort of never lose sort of sight of that. It has to, you know, at least to my mind, everything that I do in some way has to have some potential to sort of inform or give insights into or be utilized in some way, however indirect, in terms of sort of having an impact on clinical practice, having a real and meaningful impact on people's sort of lives, because that's where I started from. That's where the initial motivation was. To work in psychiatry in some sort of way, and then autism became the thing that I was, you know, most interested in, most passionate about. And, you know, I love being a scientist because I like sort of get up in the morning and hoping that some exciting new papers come out, and very occasionally one of them might be mine, but which is, you know, even better. But you sort of, there is an overarching sort of meaning which sort of comes from the patients you see in your practice. I think it's helpful and sort of important to engage in conversations with lots of stakeholders. And for me, you know, I'm not sure I'm placing clear sort of pre-specified limits on who should be part of the discussion about autism, autistic people, autistic experience, research, clinical practice. I actually think probably, you know, it's good to have as many voices as seem appropriate sort of in that sort of conversation. And, you know, in other parts of life, you know, I mean, it's sort of all sorts of issues sort of, you know, are very common at the moment about sort of, you know, platforming and deplatforming universities or whatever it sort of is, and those sort of things about, you know, who can have a voice and sort of whatever. There's a part of me that just personally always thinks that if you're setting up discussions and someone's making the rules up about who's allowed to be part of that discussion, then you're not having the fullest discussion that you might. I mean, I do think there are lines about appropriateness of statements that people make that probably shouldn't be crossed. But in terms of whether all the potential stakeholders, you know, have a right to, you know, to contribute to the discussion, I'd always say, yes, they do. And there's an interesting sort of word I hadn't come across until sort of recently, and it's actually James Cusack from Autistica who pointed it out to me in a recent sort of article. And it's apparently the opposite of consensus, which is dissensus, that actually there won't be a single thing that everyone will agree on. And I remember my ex-colleague Liz Pellicano, and Mark Steers, her husband, they've moved to Australia, but them saying this in an article several years ago, that it's not the point of these discussions and debates is to come to a sort of single consensus view. It's like that's like a sort of that's even not the point of them. It's really partly to have the discussion in ways that's informative, respectful, and has an impact on the way that things are done. That seems sort of important to me. So I'm more a person who leans towards inclusivity of sort of views, at least in the discussion. I probably have, like everyone else, my own particular preferences, and I'm sure my own particular prejudices, but I think all humans do. In terms of thinking about the next sort of generation, I think the thing is, you know, I said before that sometimes sort of change can feel frustratingly low. I think there's a bit of an open door sort of moment, you know, at the sort of moment that actually if the young autistic people beginning their career are demanding about the need for inclusive, participatory sort of involvement for autistic people in research, and almost they can, in some ways you see, they can almost drive sort of, you know, for example, what the funders are thinking and what other colleagues are thinking. And, you know, I would just urge people to be ambitious on sort of that. Partly because, you know, I belong to a generation who didn't do a very good job, and I've learned some, you know, I think over the past 30 years about doing a better job than we used to do, but maybe the rate of progress can be faster in the future. So I think that's an ambition that early career researchers should be encouraged to sign up to, because that would be a wonderful thing.